In this episode of the Smart Community Podcast, I have a fascinating conversation with Monica Olislagas, the Safe Cities Specialist at IRAP, the International Road Assessment Program. Monica tells us how moving to Ho Chi Minh City at the age of 12 sparked her interest in cities and why she is so passionate about cycling and the involvement of women in the transport sector. Monica explains a bit about the work that IRAP does in assessing star ratings for road safety for different road user groups. In the past 4 years, Monica lived in Beijing in China, and this was at a time when the city experienced its own bicycle revolution, which was driven by new technology, and we discuss some of the projects she worked on there. Monica and I cover the enormous challenge of improving road safety and how improving health outcomes in the community is directly linked with improving transport options. We finish our conversation discussing the need to question emerging technology trends in light of what kind of world we actually want to live in the future. I'm really excited to bring you this episode as part of Self Care September, or maybe what I should have called it is Community Care September. So as always, I hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as I enjoyed making it.
Welcome to the smart community, smart regions, smart towns, and smart cities. It's where we live, work, and play with smart communities. The future starts today. Big data, smart mobility, emerging trends galore. The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.
Hello, Monica. How are you today?
Hi, Zoe. I'm really well, thank you.
So good to hear. Let's jump straight in. And can you tell us about your background and what you are passionate about?
Sure. Just want to say first, thanks so much for having me on the show. It's an honour. And yeah, it's also an exciting podcast that I frequently listen to and nice to be part of.
No worries. Thanks for coming on.
Yes. So my interest in cities started when I was quite young. When I was 12 years old, my parents moved my family over to Ho Chi Minh City in Vietnam. And that couldn't have been more different to where I had been living before. I'd been living in the outskirts of Brisbane in a rural residential area. It was an area that if you ever needed to get anywhere, you had to go by car. And suddenly I found myself in the middle of a very big, very vibrant Asian city where the streets were just full of life. People played on the streets, lived on the streets, ate on the streets. And so every day you're just seeing so much happening there. And as a young teen, it was also so fundamentally different as well for getting around. I mean, everybody rode bicycles or small motorbikes. Really young kids rode to and from school on their own. And the streets were a very safe and normal place to be, even as a kid. And so I had this red bicycle. And for the first time in my life, they were my wheels to get from A to B. And so coming back to Australia a few years later made me realize how very different we approach things in our cities and how they don't necessarily have to be that way. And so I think at a very young age, I was already questioning the sort of city I want to live in when I get older. And even when it came to getting my own license, I'm thinking, well, this is ridiculous. I'm forced into car ownership. I don't actually have a choice. There is no alternative to this. And so it was something that I guess I had in the back of my mind as I went through my education. And I ended up doing a postgraduate degree in international development and started working in the Australian Government Department of Infrastructure, what was then transport. And I've just been very lucky. I fell into some fantastic jobs. I helped write Australia's first national urban policy, as well as doing a number of project proposals for bicycling projects funded at the national level. I then moved across into the high-speed rail studies and worked on that for a couple of years, which was fantastic. And then I moved to China, where I've been living for the past 4 years. I've just moved back to Canberra 6 months ago. And that was also just a really cool experience. While I was in China, I started working for a very small but global road safety organization. So I'm the organization's name is IRAP, and I'm their Safe City Specialist. And I got to work on projects across China, but also right throughout the region. And I also work in their research and development side of things. So I work a lot with different organizations in both the US and Europe on urban road safety. When it gets down to passions, I probably have a few that stand out. Bicycling, one probably born out of my days in Vietnam that has continued on. And it's not so much cycling for sport or fitness. It's very much about having bicycling as a normal, everyday thing that people do to get from A to B. So as a fundamental part of our transport system. And that's something I've been quite active in recent years. And my second passion is probably around the importance of women and transport. It's a funny one because I feel like the transport sector in Australia has been traditionally very male dominated. And it's one that in recent years, particularly traveling to Europe, but even in China, you get a lot more women in this space. And I really do believe that women have quite a fundamentally different view to how transport works for them, like what their priorities are, what their choices are. A few years ago, I was reading about a survey that was done in, I think it was done in Vienna in Austria. And they were, the people running the survey were just sort of doing this sort of regular transport survey ahead of a proposed project. And they were asking people on their way to and from work or the morning commute what their experience using the transport system were. And the observation was really interesting because they said the men spent about 2 to 3 minutes filling it out and generally had very straightforward responses. So at every day, Monday to Friday, they're taking this particular route to work and at the end of the week, they're going back. And they said the women, it was entirely different. They were spending in excess of 10 minutes writing out their responses. And it was because their use of the transport system was very, very different. It's not only to and from work. They tended to be picking children up, dropping them off, doing much more regular short trips throughout the day to pick up shopping or groceries. And then they realised that if you just have the views of a traditional male-dominated area in planning a transport system, you're actually going to leave out what is important to 50% of the population. And so this is, it was just a quirky little article, but it really stuck with me. And working in the road safety space now, I'm very conscious that you've got to have more female voices in there to help shape what transport looks like in the future.
That's really topical for me right now because I've just been on this Churchill Fellowship and I'm writing the report at the moment. I'm nearly finished, actually 97% done. And one of my biggest realizations was that me being a woman traveling alone actually affected my ability to research mobility. And what does that actually mean? And how do we kind of close that gap? And all these things that we as women are thinking about all the time, that it's not that the men don't care, it's just that they have never had to think about that before, traditionally. And now the network's being used so differently by all these different people. And, you know, in different ways, and we're just trying to fit ourselves into a network that has been designed for the traditional route of going to and from work 9 to 5, etc. And now that looks so differently. Men are using it differently, women are using it differently, people of all different abilities are using it differently. And what does that actually mean for our network, and how can we actually change the way we are planning and designing these things to bring in those needs front of mind? So you're talking my language, and it's something I have been really focusing on the last few months because I've just got back from this and what to do next about this as well.
It's such an important question, and there are so many things happening in the transport space and so many things happening outside of it that influences that it's about trying to find a way through that. The future of transport planning has to be one that is quite flexible and responsive. And I think some of our more traditional approaches, which have been quite long-term, very consultative, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but it's a way that if things are planned so many years in advance, it can, I mean, workforces can change in that time. And I think we're going through one of those transitions now. Your point exactly about how men and women and like everybody is starting to use transport systems differently. The influence of that can simply be on more casual work and different work hours and even remote working and things that are very rapidly changing in the way we actually approach things.
And I also think there's a gap in the data. And so I've been reading some books on it and articles and things at the moment. But what we actually need from our network, there is that data gap. And typically
It's a gap in the people that aren't using the network in a way that during peak time and that type of thing. So how does that actually shape the way the network looks like if we don't have all of the data to make the decisions?
Yeah. And that's actually something that is quite front and center to the work that I'm doing at IRAP. I might just explain a little bit about IRAP. So it's a small organization that works on road safety. We're active have been active in some way in over 100 countries around the world. And so for a small team of around about 20 people, we've had this enormous impact around the world, which is, it's a very cool and exciting place to be. So IRAP itself, it stands for the International Road Assessment Program. We're a UK registered charity, even though our work and our presence is global. And we have a number of countries that have essentially taken up the program and internalized it. So we have AusRAP, KiwiRAP, USRAP, EuroRAP, and ChinaRAP is also quite big. A number of other regional RAPs emerging, including ones in Brazil and India, Thailand, Pakistan, and some others. We've really got this great global presence, but the principles are quite simple around it. What we do is a star rating for road safety, but we do a star rating for the four different road user groups. So we do one for vehicle occupants, for pedestrians, for bicyclists, and for motorcyclists. And so we can star rate a road and say, okay, this road is 3 star for vehicle occupants, but only 1 star for pedestrians. And so it really starts to bring out that data, that the inbuilt risk in the infrastructure to the forefront and saying, okay, like you can no longer build a road in an urban area and not have a decent star rating for pedestrians because it becomes a moral argument. And so it's a really effective tool. It's quite cool, but absolutely central to that is data. And it's amazing when sort of trying to deal with what is a very, very big road safety issue around the world. It's 1.25 million lives every year are lost to road crashes. We've got 50% of the death rate on average in cities of pedestrians, but that goes up to in lower middle income countries, that figure can be up to 80-90% of road pedestrians. And so we're really facing this enormous challenge. And when you try and start addressing the challenge, you realize that, well, one, the crash data simply isn't available in so many places. And then like other data, like how many people are actually using the road, which is also another big factor that we've got to consider in terms of collective risk. And then there's all the data about, well, where are the footpaths across your road network? And so it's something that I would really like to help change myself, but obviously it requires a lot of different players and a lot of different data sources to bring that all together. But the opportunity is there and it's almost close enough to touch, I feel. That it's, so it's an exciting area to work, but at times a bit sort of frustrating as well.
Mm. We could talk about this all day, I guess, but I'm keen to hear a little bit more about you first and what sparked your interest in this kind of smart city, smart community space. It talks a lot about data. I'm keen to hear your thoughts about that.
So I guess for me, I find cities very, very interesting. And it probably gets back to that experience when I was a kid and when I went to live in a really big city for the first time. And just sort of, I think they can be really, really wonderful places to live, but I think they can also be terrible. And occasionally they can be both wonderful and terrible at the same time for completely different reasons. Living in Beijing for the past 4 years has been sort of one of those experiences where some aspects of that city are like, it's just a fascinating place and it's got a ton of history. It's a really cool place to get around. But then sort of half the days you're there, the air is not good enough to breathe and there's just not enough green space and you feel that, it's not working in one way or another. And I think then having sort of this grounding in transport, I mean, transport itself is an interesting field because it impacts individual lives of people so much. Everybody at some point has to get from A to B. And so everybody's got a very personal experience and everybody's got an opinion about it. It's a cool field. But I think where the smart cities comes into it is really getting that connection and integration across those different fields. So it's not just about looking at transport through a transport lens and the environment through an environmental lens and people's health and well-being through that lens. It's really about getting these things connected up and joined up. And a few years ago, I was very lucky. I got to go on a course in Denmark called the Bicycle City Masterclass. And it was really eye-opening for that reason. It wasn't just that they had fantastic bicycle paths and that the system worked really well, and now over 50% of commuters are using bicycles, even though there's very high car ownership in Denmark. It was that the health ministries and the environmental ministries and the transport ministries were all talking all of the time and understanding that if you want to improve health outcomes, you've got to improve transport options for people. And in fact, they made a conclusion in Denmark that bicycle paths, or the provision of bicycle paths so people can cycle, had as big an impact as preventing tobacco use. It was quite ironic given that lots and lots of Danes still smoke. And so, but the health disbenefit of that has almost been offset by the bicycling. But in monetary terms, the benefit was the same. And I think in Australia, we still spend about $20 billion a year on average on tobacco-related illnesses. And you think, well, if we invested that in bicycling, you could have a $20 billion a year benefit in health overall. And I don't believe about the barriers. I mean, this is a bit of a separate issue, but there's a lot of excuses in Australia as to why, well, it's fine for Denmark, but not for us, sort of thing. So a little bit off topic.
No, I agree. And it was one of the things, so I've just in this Churchill Fellowship researching mobility, smart mobility, whatever you want to call it. But essentially it was looking at the current transport network. What are the pain points that people are feeling and what are the things we're trying to do to improve? And, you know, went to 10 different countries to kind of negate that. Oh, well, it's good for Amsterdam, but it's not good for us, because actually we're all suffering with the same problems, and they're actually symptoms. They're not the cause necessarily. And, you know, congestion, pollution, inefficiencies in public transport, connectivity for everyone, and what I call WTF, which is what is the future, right? What everyone's so focused on what the future holds, which is an area that we need to focus on. What's the new things coming in? But these other things all are the same. And I think that it's not that you're going to turn Australia into Denmark, but those pain points, we can utilize the same thinking to solve some of these things. And solve isn't the right word, because you'll never solve mobility, because it's like life. It's complex. It, just try and make it better. You don't actually solve life. You just kind of live it. And I think that's really key to kind of look at these things. But if the whole piece doesn't work, then we kind of get rid of the whole thing, which is not useful, I suppose. And I agree. I think the focus, it's not that it's impossible. It's just where we put the focus and the lens. And then if we really hone in on some of these things, which we have in certain areas where it's going, oh, no, that is really bad. Smoking is really bad, which, yes, it is. But we've focused a lot of energy into putting all these things in place, these initiatives, these do not do this, blah, 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 all these things. Whereas if you said that to somebody, however long ago, I don't know, 50 years ago, they would go, oh, no one's ever get, like, it's this is how it's going to be. Can't possibly imagine it being different. It's the same thing with mobility. And you can't even imagine what it possibly could be like until we really turn that focus and hone in on these things.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think at the end of the day, smart cities has to have a human focus to it, not so much a technology focus. I think technology is an enabler in some of these things, but it's certainly not the end game. And I think the more we realise that cities ultimately are going to have to serve as healthy and equitable places for people to live long-term and sustainable, and that people's lives and their health and well-being are central to that, is where we need to be heading. And we need to be quite clear. It doesn't matter where you are in the world, but you need to be quite clear about where you want to be and not lose sight of that. Because I do think when it comes to different ideas and thinking, I mean, back in the 50s, it was around creating urban highway networks or expressway networks in order to make transport across the city more easy and quicker, but for the real purpose of attracting bigger workforces to places. But at the end of the day, you end up losing the fabric of your city that is the bit that makes them pleasant places to live. And if half of humanity is going to be living in a city, people are actually going to start demanding better cities. And I think that's happening all over the world.
I agree. And I think also like regional hubs as well, which is, you know, one of the areas that I'm really passionate about, is that we can't just continue to, well, two things. The focus on cities is an important one because there's going to be lots of people living there. But then how do we actually ensure that our regional hubs don't just become one sprawling places that no one really is caring about or whatever, but then we're bringing those services and creating those jobs and attracting the talent that is needed to actually continue those hubs and keep them active and lively in places where people really want to live. But then how you can, in mobility terms, how we can actually change the way they kind of change people's thinking of that you must own a car to drive around to get from place to place, which is what there's in Australia particularly is what is happening right now. But what are the things that are needed to change to enable a more cleaner, greener, more sustainable mobility network? And then allowing people that can't access the network right now, how can we allow them to access it in a way that's equitable? I just wanted to touch back on what you talked about in Denmark, those ministries coming together of health and transport, environment. That was one of my other real key findings, which was that where countries kind of had a separate smart city thing, like a innovation arm or a department or whatever, in the long term, maybe we don't need that. But right now, what it does is it brings those important disciplines together and kind of cuts through the, oh, well, I'm only talking about health, I'm only talking about transport. Because when you bring it in and actually have somebody with the headspace to think about what are these other areas that it's affecting, and they have no real agenda for just their getting the health budget or whatever, that seems to work really well. And you can get not just public sector working together well, but actually bringing the private sector in, bringing the startup ecosystem in, bringing the community in, because there's kind of like this space which is dedicated and has the right time, money, effort, resources available to actually do that.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think getting those cross-discipline fields actually happening, I mean, things are changing quite rapidly. I mean, I remember back when I was at university, pretty much land use planning and transportation, so road engineering, were all very separate and discrete fields. And even in sort of the years soon after that, there was a lot more about urban design that brought in the transport and the land use planning. I think there's even bigger challenges then to cross over from sort of the land use and transport side of things then into the environment, sustainability, and then again into the health. But I think it is starting to happen in some places. And I think in other places, it's far more challenging.
Yes, there's a lot of things at play here. Like, it's quite easy when you're kind of sitting in a place that has, you know, high wealth and no corruption and stuff like that. It's not impossible, but it's actually though looking at those supporting mechanisms that are required. So it's, you know, like opening up decision making and opening up transparency. The only way you can do that is by having, you know, those cross disciplines, because you can't really work together if it's not open. And then if you bring in private sector and public sector setting the rules at play, then how you can bring in people so then it's fair and equitable across the board. It's definitely not easy, but I don't think anything in life is meant to be that easy. So,
and I think the other thing we see in this space is that everywhere is different. It doesn't matter what kind of technology or what innovation happens. It's no two things are the same. And it's actually been a really exciting experience to go around the world and see how cities all over the place are doing things and going forward, but it's all in a slightly different way. Being in China, particularly, and seeing the sort of the change and the momentum and energy around the development in Chinese cities was quite fascinating. The sharing economy there has reached levels that I don't think exists anywhere else yet. So they have their equivalent of Uber, Didi, which was a local brand that existed there before Uber did. They ended up buying out Uber in China, but Didi is enormous. It's rideshare, the apps and interface are very, very well advanced. The service is fantastic and was much needed often in cities where the taxi system was not so great. But then you've also got the bike share, which I think mostly gained a bit of negative attention outside of China, but in China, it fundamentally changed things. And so I arrived in 2015, at the beginning of 2015, and I had my bicycles and I was riding around the streets and realized that there was actually no one else on bicycles. So occasionally you'd see usually a very elderly person, probably poor person on a bicycle. You'd occasionally see other foreigners, but apart from me on my bike, there were rarely any other bicycles around on the street at that time. And at the end of 2015, Mobike, which was the first of the share bike companies, started up. And within months, there were millions of bicycles on the street. So very soon after Mobike started up, Ofo, so they had bright yellow bikes. Very quickly, the field got crowded by about 30 other companies with bicycles everywhere. And yes, there were bicycle mountains, but all in all, it was people loved these things. And so I lived on a back lane, and every Sunday, I would, probably the first 2 years, I'd see families out there and they would unlock one of these bicycles and the whole family would be learning to ride a bike, because they've sort of just gone through sort of a generational gap where nobody had actually learnt to ride a bicycle as a kid. And so suddenly you just have millions of people on bikes. I mean, it just genuinely changed things overnight. I mean, it's my wildest dreams come true for a city for that to happen anywhere. But it happened not just in Beijing, but right across China in different places. I mean, Beijing was very fortunate that it preserved a lot of its bicycling infrastructure on its roads. I mean, mostly the lanes had been converted into car parking lanes and different things. But very quickly, the city then responded and they set a target to put in 3,200 kilometres of protected bike lanes within the third ring road. So I'm talking about the centre of Beijing, which they did. They achieved that. But it was quite incredible the rate of change that you'd see. Every time I left my house, there was a new bike path or a new bit of fence that would protect an existing bit of bike path, or the bike path had moved overnight. And it was just this very sort of, I mean, mind-bogglingly large scale response to a need that had virtually cropped up overnight. I mean, there was no way the city could have planned for this in advance. And it's no way it could have stood by for a couple of years going, oh, we'll build a bike path here, but we've got to wait for our budget cycles to come through. And they just started whacking out fences and paint and putting them in. So every intersection within the span of probably 5 months, every intersection across Beijing had red bicycle lanes painted across them, because they're very big intersections. And so having those pathfinding lanes to guide you across were really helpful, and I think have a really good impact on safety as well. So you see this sort of technology-driven innovation that very much comes from private sector. There was no government funding in there originally, or since, I don't think, but the municipality then responds with the infrastructure. But then you also get the companies that operate these bikes, and it's not just the bikes, but it's also Didi, the rideshare, and they're providing their data back to government. So it becomes this loop where these service providers then consider the road to be part of their service. And so they're feeding back into the government the data that's needed to improve the roads. And so it becomes this sort of situation where you've got new stakeholders in there that didn't even exist before, and new interests, and the road is actually being seen very differently to how it was seen before.
Mm. Yeah, no, it's really interesting. It's good to get, like, you know, the kind of local perspective of what's happening, like, within a community, and you can see the rapid change and how quickly that kind of happened. And we tell stories globally, but until you kind of see the place or ask a local or speak with a local, you can't actually understand what it is and what it isn't. So I think it's really important to kind of share those stories of not just what the general media are saying, but then those local examples as well, both, you know, successes and failures, because there'll be obviously some big things that people learnt from that experience as well.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting one. It's all tied up with all of the innovation and change and technology, but the ability to talk between cities and to share ideas and to communicate now, I think it's doing a lot for people in this sector in itself. I use LinkedIn, for example, because it's a really good one. I mean, for the first time as a professional in this field, it's no longer just the people you know within your city or your region who are working on similar things. You have the ability to then connect across the world. And things like even this podcast, which is fantastic because you have an opportunity to have a conversation, which before probably was within the confines of conferences, but now so much more accessible. And it's a platform where ideas can be shared. And there's a lot of different podcasts and different things. It's almost like having a radio station just devoted to your interest, of like your field of work, which is just something that didn't ever exist before. So it's very exciting. That really cool place we're in right now.
Yeah, I agree. And I think like some of the what we would call quite basic now really has changed the way we work and we operate and how we connect. And it's not, you know, super advanced stuff that no one's ever thought about before, but it was just kind of incremental change and just kind of a different way of doing things. And then how that really changed our lives, I suppose. And then also kind of that sharing of knowledge and making it accessible. I mean, that's what I wanted for the podcast. It was one, I wanted to learn more, and then I also wanted other people to learn more so then I would have more cool people to talk with, really, essentially. And then, you know, it's like networking on steroids because you just have the best conversations and then you share that with other people. And, you know, the amount of people that are like, oh, I heard so-and-so on your podcast and now I've talked to them and we're working together. It's like, well, that's amazing and awesome and I love it. And I guess like going back to this whole smart city thing or whatever, that's actually what it means. It means that we enhance our lives, right? That our lives are better, and not just our lives, but people that couldn't access this information before because they didn't know how to, or maybe they didn't even realize they were interested in it. And then actually opening up that conversation, because I think there's way too many times where the conversation is so closed off and you're in an echo chamber of how great you are because everyone else around you says how great you are and aren't you all so great? And no one's ever going to challenge you because you only talk to people that have the same opinion as yourself. I do really think that this smart community thing is somewhere where we can have these conversations that it's, you're not going to have the same opinion as somebody else, which is great because then you can actually have robust and real discussion about these things and open, honest conversations. And you can only do that when you have a safe space to be able to kind of learn and access this information. And, you know, there's so much change happening. It's this time of uncertainty. But if we don't do anything, then we just let it happen to us. And I think that's where like the smart community thing comes in. Well, no, we can actually be involved no matter what your background is. You don't have to be a coder or whatever. I just don't think this movement, which smart city, whatever you want to call it, I don't think it will go away easily because I think it's the right one to actually bring together placemaking, bring together, you know, mobility, bring together the community, that human aspect, while also keeping front of mind that we can't keep doing things the way we've always done them. And the change now isn't just based on what the CEO or the Prime Minister or whatever is wanting. It's actually coming from the people, and that'll be the change that we see in the world.
Yeah. And I really hope it makes people a little bit braver as well. I think we're always worried to try new things on some level or another, particularly I feel this in transport in Australia a little bit. It's just nobody really wants to change things up too much because they have no idea what the consequences will be and it could be disastrous. But actually, when you see different places and examples of where things are trialed, and particularly for me in the safety space, where you see some innovative things going on. And yeah, you might not get it completely right the first time, but if you get in there and give something else a go, you might actually be surprised. And I think that's where people looking at those examples and learning from them suddenly go, oh yeah, actually, I don't need to feel quite so worried because that it worked in that place. So let's give it a go here. And it does make us a bit braver. We did this really cool project in Yangpu district in Shanghai. So Yangpu is one of the older areas. It was actually the first textile manufacturing district in China. So the first place fabric was made. So it's got lots of these really cool old factories along the waterfront, and they're turning them into cafes and art spaces. And so it's quite a cool place. But there's a lot of universities around there as well. The city has, like, Shanghai has quite big roads. They're not quite as bicycling friendly as Beijing streets. And with the university students in particular, they tend to have a lot of books. And so they use the wheelie bags, like luggage bags, but the footpaths are really rough. And so when we were doing our assessments in Yangpu District, you could see all these people, young people, walking up and down the tarmac on this road with their wheelie bags. And the city was saying, oh, this is such a problem. We can't get them to walk on the footpath. And so we worked with the city and the World Resource Institute to improve the design of this road. So the road is called Zhengtong Road, and it was a two-way road. So they made it a one-way road, but with two-way bicycling lanes on each side, and then upgraded the footpath. And it completely changed the way this road worked. But it was really funny. I went there halfway through construction, so only half of this bicycle lane was built. And while the workmen were still there with the jackhammers on one end, people were riding up to the start of the bicycle lane and lifting their bicycle over the curb to get onto the lane and would continue riding along. So right at that point, you could see, hey, this is working for someone. But it was quite funny. So that particular example was fantastic. And the city then received a five-star certification for pedestrians and bicyclists on that road. But we went to another district very close by, still in Shanghai, and they looked at what we were proposing and they said, oh, this doesn't meet our specifications. This would make the road more dangerous. Like, oh, actually, these people in a few districts over have just done it and it's worked out really well for them. And so you could see suddenly their eyes going, oh, okay, so maybe if we make a decision outside of the box, like, it's going to be okay and we can try this. And yeah, it's since been great. This particular district then had a number of assessments done and a number of challenges, and they're actually raising the next big road safety challenge for them, which is heavy vehicle crashes with pedestrians and bicyclists. And so that's the next big thing we're doing. But what we ultimately do there will probably then have a bigger impact on the rest of China. We're like, oh, they solved that problem. So sometimes you feel like you're working in quite small spaces, then you realize the impact of this is huge.
It's huge, yeah. And you talk about like the courage, or the takes one person to have that, your bravery or courage or whatever, to go, okay, no, we're going to do this a bit differently. And then the ripple effect, or the spiderweb effect of that, if one person says, oh, yep, cool, we're going to give this a go, then it makes it safe for other people, which is awesome.
It is.
Okay, well, we've kind of run through all of those questions. I just want to finish on these last two, which is, what are the emerging trends that people aren't talking about enough?
I think this is a bit of a difficult question, because when I think of trends, I guess I'm thinking of the things that are being talked about. It's just that sometimes it's hard to know what the trend actually means. Like, for example, like, everyone knows how much technology has been and is a game changer. I mean, smartphones alone. Now, like, if you go to Beijing, you can use your smartphone to get directions. You can find and hire and unlock a bicycle with it. You can book a car. It tells you how many calories you burned on your trip. Use your smartphone to pay for everything there. It's how you have group conversations. It's how you get your news. Like, it's absolutely endless how that small device has impacted lives, particularly in China, which has sort of was probably a couple of steps behind where most high-income countries were with technology up until that point. So I think it's hard to see where the next 5 or 10 years might take us. And we all know that this stuff is changing and the rate of change is only increasing. But where we're going to land with it and how we prepare ourselves to respond to that next wave of technology is just challenging. I mean, it's just the very nature of it that we just don't know. And so we've sort of got to keep our eyes peeled, and lots of people are talking about lots of different things, but how we respond to that, I'm just not sure. I want to get back to an earlier point I made, which is you've got to have a very good idea and a clear idea of where you want to get to, where your ultimate end goal is. And I think for me, autonomous vehicles is one of these, because so often in the transport space, that's what people are talking about. And while I think, yes, the technology is certainly moving in that direction, isn't something that we necessarily want. Like, is a car without a driver any better than a car with a driver, ultimately? And what happens when, instead of cars spending 90% of their life parked somewhere, that they're suddenly all on the roads? And I think there's lots of questions and issues that I don't think people have properly thought through. And the technology itself, I mean, it's very hard to make sure that a automated vehicle would be able to anticipate other road users, like non-vehicle road users. And so there's a lot of issues there. And I feel like sometimes those sort of things drive people to go, oh yeah, it's a new technology. Like that's where we're going. That's where the future is. It's like, well, it doesn't have to be. Like the future could be bicycles. It could be walking. It could be lots of things. What I hope it is it's all of those things in some way or another. But yeah, I think it's really important that we just have a clear idea. And of course, it'll be slightly different for everyone depending on where they are and local issues, but to know where you're heading with it rather than just getting buffeted by the next wave of things.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. It's been great to chat with you. And I look forward to our next conversation. Now that you're back in Australia, we met when we were both in Beijing. I was passing through when you were living there. I remember you riding there, I think, to our meeting at some point. But anyway, it was really great to chat with you. And I'd be keen to have another conversation at some point as well. So yeah, thanks again.
Likewise. Thank you, Zoe.
No worries. I just have one last question, which is how can people connect with you?
Probably best on LinkedIn. So just under, search me by name, Monica Olislugs, and you'll find me there.
Excellent. Well, thanks again. And yeah, look forward to our next conversation.
Likewise.
Talk soon. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening to the Smart Community Podcast. Show notes for this episode and all other episodes are available on our website, mysmart.community. If you have any questions for us or any of our guests, you can email hello@mysmart.community or find us on the socials. We are on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter @smartcompod. That's com with two M's. If you are enjoying the podcast, please leave us a rating and review at wherever you listen. This really helps us reach more ears, so thank you in advance. As always, I hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as I enjoyed making it.
The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.